Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about the lanthanides, way, way down the bottom of the periodic table. In most periodic tables that you have in your diary or book, it's broken up into a short form, and the lanthanides and actinides are in a sort of a little sub-table all of their own down the bottom, and with little arrows indicating how it should actually look in the very long periodic table, of course. People don't really have the long books for the long periodic table, so the periodic table has a series of blocks in it, which the S block, the D block, the P block, and underneath the F block. And I call them little subtables. And in this episode, I'm going to actually go through and actually cover the very last block, the F block down there. And I call them subtables because when you look at them, the structure is the same structure in each of those blocks. Now, those blocks refer to the shape of the lines that you get when you chuck it in a flame and look at it through a prism or a spectrometer. The lines have historically been described as sharp, principal, as a sort of big and bold principal, diffuse, D block, or F for fine. And that's really telling you about how the electrons behave within their atoms. And we're going to go into this, that there's different forms of shells of the atoms, shapes of the electrons. Electrons can actually have a shape, and this is in quantum mechanics. Now, if it's got just a perfectly circular shape, it's in the S. If it's got just one cut through the centre, so you can imagine a ball of Play-Doh, and you get a ruler, and you cut it through the centre. Once, it's a P block. Twice, it's a D block. So if you cut down and then at, say, 90 degrees to that, you'll get a D-shaped electron. So it's got two radial nodes. So this is angular nodes as you go around, or azimuthal nodes, as they're called. And, of course, the F block is the last one. You've got three cuts, so you can actually do it. Just sit on the top, cut it up like a pizza, but into six slices. And those are the actual shape of the electrons, and the shape of the electrons really determine the chemical characteristics. And the chemical characteristics are quite interesting. And the chemical characteristics determine the shapes and the size of the block, what you can evolve. It's a lot of physics, or lots of physics and science in there. Now, the S block is too wide. The P block is 6 wide, the D block is 10 wide, and the F block is 14 wide. And if you want to know the mystery of the formula there, you get a factor of 2 for the two spins of the electrons. The electrons can either spin up and spin down. And so it's 1 times 2, 3 times 2, 5 times 2, and 7 times 2 is 14. And our bottom block is got 14 elements across in the full block of it. So if you go into the dynamic periodic table, which I really recommend you do, so you just type into Google dynamic periodic table, it will take you to a website called www.ptable.com, and up onto the right hand of the screen, particularly if you've got a nice wide monitor, press wide and your periodic table will expand to its natural form. It'll be able to observe the kingdom of the elements, some 100 elements. And it's taken me about two, possibly 3 weeks of just slowly plugging through, reading all the elements, and then going back and looking at different strips and groups, and eventually learning bits and bits, and so I can pretty well know them all through the P, S, P, and D blocks. This is the top part of the table. Now I'm trying to learn the bottom part of the table, and the bottom part of the table is perhaps the most treacherous, I think, because the elements are so similar at the top. They're all pretty much the same metal, and they're similar. And so it's 14 of them, so it's been a real struggle for me to remember, say, the top row of the D block, the middle bit between the lithium beryllium part and the boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, neon part, that bit underneath them. But those 10 elements go across as scandium, titanium, vanadium, chromium, iron, or iron, cobalt, nickel, zinc. Sorry, iron, cobalt, nickel, copper, zinc as you go across. Once you remember that, you can sort of remember as you go down across. It requires to go over and over again. And when you come across very similar sounding elements, you have to sort of take it by the horn and look at them all, the similar ones going across. So, of course, and a lot of them have a similar name because they are named after the same place. So, the place which we referred to before is yttrium, ytterbium, erbium, and terbium. They're all four elements named after the same place, and they're all very similar style of elements because they were all found in the same type of rock. Now, what we're going to do is go over the lanthanums, and there's 14 of them, and I'm just going to see if I can do this. And so this is the entire aspect, is that I will study it, think about it, test myself, podcast about it, and come back. But going back on the 14 elements across in the F block, this is the very bottom. So the normal periodic table is 2 plus 10 plus 6 is 18 across, so you've got 14 at the bottom. So the top little one that you have, that little castle shape, it's sort of got a tower on one side, a flat living quarters sort of 10 across, and then a 6 across, sort of a little tower, and another few little, looks a bit like a castle, Windsor Castle, and at the front is the sort of stables, is the F block. But doing the F block is the lanthanums, lanthanides. So ides can be chlorides, but when in this case, it's not that it's a negative ion. It means that these are like it. So the word ide can mean two things. It can mean a negative ion, a chloride, or the lanthanides is another use of the word ide. It means similar to it. So a lot of people had a lot of trouble. Could I put a lanthanide in the lanthanum, in the lanthanides? Because lanthanum is lanthanum. It's not like lanthanum. So there's this circular argument going around. It wasn't a great argument, but it certainly was going around for a while. So let's go through the 14 elements. There's lanthanum, which is an odd element. There's cerium, after the Ceres, which is the little planet out there, and that's named after the goddess of the harvest. So cerium is really cereal. That's what we get it. There's praseodymium, which means pressing, it means green twin, and neodymium, it means new twin. Sort of that's pretty amazingly boring to go across. So let's go, that's one, two, three, four. We've done so far, and that's 4 out of 14. So there's 10 more to go. And so that's now the twin story is a real twin story, and when you listen to it, they thought it was a twin. It wasn't a twin, but it was a twin. It was a twin, and then they divided it between the two. So praseodymium is one of the color elements. It says it's colorful, and so this goes on. But these are all very similar. They're all rare earths. They're all metals. They can all burst into flame in the air, or react with water. All very interesting, and of course you know neodymium from neodymium magnets. Next one is promethium, which is a it's not a stable element, so they're out of your 82 82 is by lead. Is the 83 is the last one, but out of those 82, two of them are unstable. So there's only 80 stable, truly stable elements. Bismuth is pretty stable, but it's unstable over the lifetime of the universe, so it's just on the edge. So there's really only 81 stable elements, and behind, inside the periodic table, beneath, going down, you get praseodymium, so promethium, so Prometheus. Then after that, you get samarium. Now, samarium is interesting in that it was actually named after an ore, and the ore was named after a Russian mine official. So after a long sort of tradition of not naming people on the periodic table, a mining bureaucrat got in on the periodic table. And it'd be nice to research a bit about him. And that's got six, so we're almost halfway through. Then we have europium. And this is the sort of like bashing away at trying to name Yitterbury. So we've named Yitterbury a village, which means outer village in Swedish. That's what it means, village. And you're just bashing away with it. So we've got four attempts to name it. And then it's in Scandinavia. It's in Europe. It's this it's a suburb of Stockholm. There's another ancient, sort of a different word for Sweden. So they just really hammer away at trying to say, look, this point to this place. So there's europium, which has got rather spectacular story to it, and we'll come back to it. And there's something I want to actually stop. So hold that thought. There's gadolium GD. That's after europium. That's eight. Now, that's the magic thing. It's moved across the midpoint. So you've got the system of from yttrium down to lutetium, all the way down to lanthanum. Some, I don't know, 16 or 17 elements which are classified as rare earth elements, and they're called the REE. And you have the REEs divided up into two sets: the LREE, which is light rare earth elements, which are those first seven, and the next seven are the heavier elements. And the abundance of it, well, it's just follow that rule that we've done before, which is, if it's got a even Z number, it's common. If it's an odd Z number, it's less stable. And I find that really interesting from a quantum physics aspect to it, because you've got these nucleons which have got their wave functions, and I myself have really stuck with the purest viewpoint of the nuclear potential inside the Saxon Woods potential from the 50s. I think that's by far the best potential, and it explains the most aspects of the nuclear process. It explains things like stable nuclei and instability of nuclei. But you've got uranium, gadolium, it refers to yet another person. I think it was discovered after samarium, but gadolium, and refers to yet another bloke, some sort of Finnish geologist or something like that, who had an ore, discovered an ore, and his ore happened to have an element, so he just sort of fell into the periodic table. Then there's, after that, there's gadolium, there's terbium, so I don't know how many we're in, we're 8, 9 across terbium. Now, the story of terbium is, there's ytterbium, and then it's a contraction of it. They called it erbium and terbium, just to break up the same yttrium, to get the same, which really doesn't mean anything in Swedish except small village. I don't know why they went bananas on it. And I don't know whether that was the pink one or the non-pink one. There's a mix-up between erbium and terbium. The person naming it got the label on their jars wrong, and so that mistake's got in him. Then there's is a dy the element dipropsium. I can't pronounce it. Dipropsium, and this one is an interesting one. So it means hard to find. There's nothing really to be said about the element. No one uses it for anything. It really has to get the new crown as the most irrelevant element ever in the periodic table. It's the one which is sort of like this person walking off the street to be in the family photograph of elements, and the person just got it and said, "All I can say is that it was really hard to find." And so the Greek for hard is that dys, drus, drus, diprosium. Remember that? It's such a rare element. Then there's the element after that. There's 14, so if your brain is exploding, so is mine. It's holmium, which is named after Stockholm. It's 67, so it's a rarish element. And I'm sure it's been used in some components somewhere. Then there's the famous erbium. So these are the elements that when they got them, they sort of discover them and then almost immediately use them. So that's used in the... it happens to be at the optical fiber wavelength to make a nice glass laser. And the entire thing about rare earths and glasses, they work together because their electron configuration means that are not completely affected by the glass, and they can still fluoresce. So a lot of these things fluoresce and glow in the dark, and that's exactly what you need in a laser, because the laser, you want to pump it, and it fluoresces as it lasers. It's sort of like a dye laser. Now, the thing that really does it is europium, is the one that is a real glow-in-the-dark rare earth. It's a fluorescent one. Then, after that, after erbium, is another rare child. So it's usually the odd ones are about a factor of 10 less common. That's thulmium. And thulmium is really another word for scandium. So the scandium, thulmium is named by Sweden again. And then finally, there's ytterbium. Now, ytterbium's, for me, I always get confused. The YAG laser is a YAG, ytterbium. I know they were using it in different optical fibre lasers, so it was all the rage in the optical fibre technology unit. What I want to do is come back and discuss some of the wild childs. If you can get your periodic table thing and expand it up, what I want you to do is go to properties and look at, you could look at the density as one thing. You could also look at the melting point. The melting point's a bit more, oh, I don't know, it's got a bit more numbers involved in it. Now, I'm going to get your mind into the zone a bit by getting you to look at the D block. The D blocks we mentioned before, and we go across the D block again. So it's scandium, titanium, vanadium. Vanadium means pretty element, so which is sort of like beautiful element, as opposed to dysprosium, Dy, the most unknown element, unknowable element, which is just hard to find. Chromium. Now, what does chromium mean? Chrome means colourful element. There you go, chrome. Manganese. So manganese is it's a fairly rare but very important element. There's manganese nodules on the bottom floor, and magnesium And manganese come from the same area in Greece where magnetics comes from, and it all stems from this guy called Magnus, whose foot had an iron nail in his new shoe, and he went for a walk as a shepherd with his new shoe, and his shoe got stuck, and he discovered the magnetic field, and the magnetic field was so important they named the entire magnetism after him. So and the magnesia, and so you've got manganese, which is different from magnesium, but it's the same origin. Then you've got iron, cobalt, nickel, copper, and zinc. Now, one of the things is that the melting temperature, scandium has got a melting temperature of, I don't know, 1,500-ish, and then it slightly increases up to chromium, which is the fourth way, and that's around 2,200 degrees, and then it suddenly plunges down, say 700 degrees. So manganese is suddenly much easier to melt. And then coming up, you get iron. Iron is intensely magnetic, just remember that. And so is manganese, and then cobalt. And what happens is that manganese drops down. Iron has got a slightly higher melting temperature than manganese, 1800. So it suddenly jumps up another 300 degrees. So if you're looking for a trend, it's sort of like it's not a trend. It's sort of cruising up, drops down, picks up again, and then it cruises down eventually. From iron to cobalt to nickel to copper to zinc. Zinc is got a quite a moderate melting temperature, and this process happens again as you go down to different periods. This is period number 4 as you're going across, and we're looking at period number 6. Okay, so if you get in your mind, let's just fucking do it sort of a hill rising up high, and then it drops. It's got a little divot in it, and then it rises up again, and then falls off again. So that's a pattern in the periodic table. Now, if we go backward to the F block, the same thing happens with the F block. It's like this is why it's a subtable, it's a pattern within it. So lanthanum starts off, and the melting temperature, the temperature at which it melts, goes steadily up, and the samarium has got the highest melting temperature of it. And then at europium, which is at the seventh element across, manganese is the fifth, 5 out of 10. Europium 7 out of 10. It suddenly plunges down, so it's not as dramatic. It plunges down to about 1,000 degrees, and the samarium's about 1,350. So it's a similar drop, or it's not as dramatic drop. It's half a drop, and then the next one after it picks up again, but it picks up to a the what is it? The melting temperature increases, so it's barely the same. It's like it's an unusual trip up. It's like you couldn't say this is a pattern in the periodic table. For the D block, the melting temperatures go up, drip down, and up again, up and down. Now the F block does exactly the same thing, whereas manganese and europium is the same across. Now, a small little story for europium is that the people have figured out how to make a colour telly. They've the mechanism, but they didn't have the phosphorus, the red phosphorus. So the red phosphorus they had was just pretty useless. So get a colour TV, but it would only work in a very, very dark room because it could not produce a lot of light, because it couldn't produce a very red light. So they could produce the other phosphors really bright, bright green, and whatever it is, bright, I suppose it would be blue colour. And so the colour tellies were in this real sort of bind. We know how to make a colour telly, but we don't have a phosphorus. And of course, the phosphorus, which is sort of the ultimate red phosphorus, glows incredibly bright red, is europium. And so just in the nick of time, they've discovered europium is a really rare element. And we can just use it. And then they found a massive ore body of europium, for a couple of percent or a fraction of a percent, which usually it's a real trace element because europium has got the odd number of nucleons, so it's a, you know, it's one of these odd number of protons, so it's really rare. So that's an interesting thing, that europium corresponds to manganese. It's got a very low melting point. Then we've got the thing about the periodic table is you look at patterns and rules, and the basic rule is that everything in the F block, its outer electrons, its outer configuration is, well, if it's S, it's S. If it's D, it's the D-shaped electrons. Or if it's P, it's the P-shaped electrons. Not so for the F block. And this is a very important, for me, it's a very important thing because I'm a rules-based person. So what happens is that electrons, I'm just trying to work this out, because the electrons ideally would be, you would think, would have lowest energy. So the electrons themselves have a little magnetic field. The magnetic field comes from the fact that their rotation has sort of left our universe. So they are rotating, but there's no part of the electron. You could put a little piece of white hat on and count how fast it rotates. And furthermore, when it's rotating, there's to produce its magnetic field, it's actually spinning. Every time it spins once around in our universe, it's spun twice around in its universe. It takes 720 degrees for it to do a spin. And that gives you a factor of two. And then there's other factors of it seeing ghost or virtual electrons around itself. And so this drag gives you another factor. And it's one of these things that we've been able to calculate and work out and sort of really journey into the fantastic world of the electron by actually just by telling us it's got a magnetic field. We can actually say, hey electron, I can actually work out quite a lot about you. And so what happens is that the electrons are actually big and they sit through each other. And so in general, when you first fill up an electron, so there's a space of 14 electrons in this period, in the F block, and the first set of electrons all go into separate, spatially separate orbitals, which sort of makes sense. It means that they occupy different areas of space, and rather than actually point some point up, some point down, their lowest energy state is all the north poles pointing north, and then this would be impossible to predict or conceptualize if you actually believe the electrons are tiny little dots, and you say, well, here the dots are all orbiting and you have your north and south poles facing up. The lowest energy is not going to be all the north that's going up. Some will point south and north and will all tend to cancel each other, but this is not the case, because you have to actually go into quantum mechanics to understand it. So your first seven electrons all point, are unpaired, they all point upwards, and so this is getting yourself one hell of a magnetic unpaired electrons. Your unpaired electrons are meaning all the norths are pointing upwards, and they can correspond. And so this is why samarium is a high temperature magnet. Neodymium is promethium is just it decays. It's not a stable atom, so we can just chuck that out. Samarium, for some reason, isn't as strong as it. I'll have to work that out. So it's sort of like saying that the equivalent of neodymium is around chrome. So yeah, that's a bit of a head scratcher as to why that is. Neodymium is such a good, powerful magnet. The other thing you have to remember in making these magnets, they use nanotechnology. It's a ceramic magnet. It's a ceramic version. It's not actually a metal magnet. It's a ceramic sintered magnet. It's all to work. The actual physics of getting this to work is amazing. Point that I want to do, and there's a lot of its magnetic properties are really fascinating and just hard to understand. I can sort of see how they can be ferromagnetic, how they can be anti-ferromagnetic and spiraling as well. It's just that does my head in these rare earths. The really important thing is gandalium, which is the one after europium. So it's the one where it's got seven double buckets, four electrons, and the double buckets can have a spin and spin up, spin down. So the first seven buckets have an electron in each, all spin up, and the next bucket it would be a spin down one. So you'd have one, you would think, and iron is exactly like this, is in the D block there are five double buckets, and it all manganese is all spin, all five are spin up, and then iron you've got four unpaired electrons and a double bucket, a spin up, spin down. But as you can see, gadolim, I can't pronounce it, gadolim, there's GD. If you ask anyone what the element is DY is, you'd have to ask. The second question is, why do you know about it? Haven't you got a life? But gadolim is actually quite an interesting element, because when you look at it, it's got these seven electrons and it was seven double pairs where it can put in. So really, if I can say, if you're at the periodic table, you press orbitals a bit and you can actually see the electrons poke into these orbitals, and you can see the shape of at least the top of orbital. I really wish that we had a better illustration of what's going on. So we've got the just sort of drum roll is that the next electron doesn't go into the F shell of gandalium. Gandalium is this wild child of the periodic table. Its next electron is in the D block. It's got its next electron in is in the D, and it goes up. So it's a D electron. It does have unfenyled F shells, a majority, but it also has a D shell, and that's pretty unheard of. I must admit, I don't know of any other element that has a partially filled F, or obviously gandalium's the only one, but a partly filled D and P shell. There might be. Gandalium is just this insane one. So it's got eight unpaired electrons. And so it's pretty magnetically amazing. And it's one of these things which, and I don't know if it's associated with it, but if you put it in a magnetic field, it heats up and then settles down, and then you take it out of the magnetic field, it will cool down. It's this magnetic, cryomagnetic effect. It's a fairly weird effect, and I saw this just completely insane Japanese person, Japanese, of doing this magnetic refrigerator. And I'm sure you could use it. It's a very weird effect, a very weird element. And so that's the the F block. And my real interest in the F block is the fact that europium apes and follows magnesium, sorry, manganese, in terms of the boiling temperature, and that gondolin is this completely insane element which, besides, elects to have 8 unpaired electrons. And of course, the next element along says, "Look, this is insane." And the next element along, which is not—it's not that wild child element, DY. I really can't remember at this stage across. So there you have it. This is late at night, and my yet another periodic table discussion. And what it has done is just brought that into my head. And so I know that, say, the seventh element along is erbium. Is europium. The element before that is promethium. The elements, two elements before that is, I've just lost them. I really have, unfortunately. A bit later, oh, that's five. Then neodymium, praseodymium. Cerium and lanthanum. So I'm beginning to learn back and forth. So eventually I will get to the full periodic table as I discuss and think about the different aspects of the periodic table. So I hope you've enjoyed this particular episode. Thanks for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.